Welcome to Enterprise Linux Security, episode 93, where we're going to talk about why the New York Times has so many repositories, among more important stories. How you doing, Zhao?
All good. As always, a pleasure being here with you, Jay. We're going to be looking at some stories that touch on cybersecurity. But first, I'm really happy to start with an update, actually a follow-up to the story that we closed in on the last episode, which you may recall was about a proposed law that would be voted on in the European Union. And basically that law would force all the media companies and all the media providers to essentially scan every single message that flowed through their platforms. For platforms that offer end-to-end encryption, that would be impossible to do unless they broke the end-to-end encryption, which has countless other problems, and it's really a very slippery slope to get to. So the update is that the proponents for that bill pulled it before the vote because they couldn't gather enough support. So that's a very big win for everybody trying to defend end-to-end encryption and trying to make sure that your communications and your data and basically your systems online remain secure and confidential. And
yay.
I was very pleased with learning about that.
Yeah, me too. So we have that update there. We're going to get into the New York Times also, but also we're going to talk about Ticketmaster. But I wanted to talk about this story regarding the New York Times, and we're not going to spend too much time on this one because I feel like it's going to be another one of those, yeah, you covered a story like that before. But then again, if people learn their lesson, then we wouldn't really have this conversation. So apparently the New York Times has had 5,000 repositories taken over. But first of all, the New York Times, 5,000 software repositories, 270 gigabytes of data. And we were talking before this, a source code, right? Of just text. So we were talking before we hit the record button, trying to rationalize how the New York Times has this much. But the actual story here is not why they have so many things. That's what I'm fixating on. The actual story is that somebody apparently had an API key or some kind of authentication token that belonged to the New York Times in a public repository. And what could possibly go wrong if your authentication token for your company's protected systems is right there out in the public? And sure enough, that's what happened. Now, we've talked about this kind of thing before. This is not the first time that either of us have talked about somebody including information in a repository that would then later lead to chaos. And now 5,000 repositories and 3.6 million files. So the New York Times is allegedly in someone else or, you know, accessed. So the part that I can't get around here is, like, you know, we think about the Linux kernel, and you were saying it's probably around 40 million lines of code in the Linux kernel or something like that.
Yeah, something around that order. Probably a bit higher, but not that much.
So here we have the New York Times with 3.6 million files, not lines of code, 3.6 million files. The Linux kernel has 40 million lines of code or some number that's egregiously high. But then I was thinking, you know, 3.6 million files, each one of these files, you know, presumably has more than one line in it. So we could potentially have more source code at the New York Times than the Linux kernel, but I digress. The real story here is that this is another example of why it's a bad idea to store your authentication key, passwords, whatever it is, out in the open. I feel like I probably don't need to have this conversation with our audience, but we need to educate people on this because it happens way too often, and this is not going to be the last time we talk about authentication-related issues on today's episode.
Yeah, but again, for try as hard as I can, I cannot get past the numbers here. How does the New York Times have 5,000 repos and 3.6 million files for a total of 270 gigabytes of source code? I mean, there are many software development houses out there that do not have this amount of repos or source code files or even source code amounts altogether. It's weird. And they make a point of stating that part of what was stolen or illegally accessed was the Wordle source code. If you're familiar with Wordle, it's a simple, say me who never tried to code a Wordle, but a word association game where you just associate letters and try to form the next word that comes up. It's really basic, so it won't account for much of those 270 gigabytes anyway. But still, again, illegal, a token that was exposed somehow. Apparently the New York Times came out and said that it was only made available for a short period of time in January, which shows, if nothing else, just keeping those credentials available for a really short amount of time is no security measure, because somebody is always watching and somebody is always searching for this type of information. So regardless if it's seconds, minutes, or days at a time, somebody will see the information that you publish.
Yeah, and somebody should probably let the New York Times know that if they wanted to open source all of their projects, there was probably a better way to do it than just leak a key into GitHub. But surprise, now it's open source, but not legally. It's incredible. So,
really big facepalm moment there.
Yeah, it's a red forehead facepalm moment. But the main story is Ticketmaster, and I have a lot of notes on this, so I'm going to try to go through this. But effectively, we have several players in this Ticketmaster story. So I'll go through the players first. We have Ticketmaster, obviously, owned by Live Nation. Santander, if I'm saying that right, a financial services. What was that?
Santander. It's a Spanish
Santander.
Bank. It's okay. A Spanish bank that now has a worldwide presence. They're a very big name in Europe. I don't know their reach in the US, but they're a really big player in the European market.
Oh, okay. Good to know. I actually haven't heard of them before this, so I that's new to me. So then there's a cloud provider with a name that I was trying to make a joke about for the title of the podcast, but didn't come up with one. A cloud provider called Snowflake. Now, we're about to see a little bit of how delicate this cloud provider is, or at least happened to be, but we'll get to that. So we have those three players in the story: Ticketmaster, Santander, if I'm even saying that right this time, and then Snowflake, their cloud provider. So basically, this story, I believe it first came out around May 27th, I believe. And essentially what we have here is, you know, first of all, Ticketmaster is a company everyone loves to hate, but we don't really want or wish anything like this on them. That's famous for, you know, the ticket prices and all these things. So there's a cloud provider called Snowflake. And then my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ticketmaster is a tenant. They're one of the customers that resides on Snowflake. And there's others. There's other ones here. MasterCard being one of them, Adobe, Canva, which I, you know, famously use for thumbnails for the YouTube channel, they all use Snowflake. So around June 1st, the previous Friday, it was reported that threat actors claim to have around 500 million records. Santander, their financial provider, also confirmed it suffered a data breach impacting millions, allegedly the same hacker group at the time. So at the time that this was reported, what was stolen wasn't known yet. It wasn't clear. We still have a little bit of unknown around this, and it's still developing, obviously. So at that time, it was thought that this might be linked to company accounts with the hosting provider, a cloud provider, Snowflake. And now, first of all, we have to really understand something before we go any further. So we're not talking about, you know, Ticketmaster yet. We're talking about the cloud provider. We're talking about someone at the cloud provider facility. And obviously, there's other tenants. So then the question is automatically, okay, well, if this impacted Ticketmaster, could it impact other tenants? Is this just Ticketmaster, or is this a bigger problem? And it looks like it probably is. So on May 27th, is when the details first emerged. So basically what I, according to my notes in my research, a forum account posted a claim that they had 1.3 terabytes of Ticketmaster data, including personally identifiable information for, it was said, 560 million people. They claimed to have names, addresses, email addresses, phone numbers, ticket sales. So, you know, if they like a really corny band, I guess everybody will know. And also some credit card details. So what was you know, allegedly stolen here is basically everything that somebody needs to take over someone's identity, spear phishing, you name it, because we have all of the ingredients. So when they say some credit card details, that could mean that they have like the last four digits, but not the whole card number, which is great if they don't have the whole thing. They didn't really specify in the article I read. But if you have the last four digits and you have the person's address and you have this, and this has happened, people call customer service. They could pretend to be that person. They have all that information, and that's basically everything, anything that they would ever need. So basically, it's open source intelligence, but it's obviously not leaked on purpose. Now, the hack... Oh, go ahead.
Let me just add something there. When you were listing the names of the players involved, you left out another name that was probably discussed and chosen in the same meetings that the FBI and law enforcement named their operations. So the hackers involved call themselves Shiny Hunters, which, again, amazing name.
Is that a Pokemon reference?
Absolutely no idea, but still, an amazing name. You were talking about Snowflake. Snowflake is a data storage. It's a big data analysis company. They provide services for companies that have lots of data, and they help make sense of that data. The tricky thing here is that while the entire story points to a hack that happened right now, there have been some reports that say that the data that was made public is actually older than the breach. It might have been compiled from public breaches, and there are groups out there that basically just aggregate data from the different breaches that occur. So when this type of data gets posted into a public forum on hacking, you will get people having access to large amounts of data and then just adding to other databases that they buy on a different occasion. And that's why you sometimes see data dumps with more entries for people than there are people on the planet. It's at that massive level. But please do continue. Sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no worries. I appreciate that. Yeah. Shiny Hunters. Speaking of which, so after, you know, when this started going down, so let me see. So there's a notice that was posted on the 27th of May asking for $500,000. But days later, the hacker group claimed to be selling 30 million customer details and staff info that they claim to have retrieved from Santander, and they're trying to sell it for 2 million. So here we have the financial services provider. And my understanding is that they were not really as forthcoming about there being a cloud provider. It was, you know, the tech press could easily put this together. It's not hard to find where things are hosted. They might have admitted it later on, but anyway, so you have the financial services provider, you know, they're, you know, in the mix here. There's some hacking activity going on there. And Mandiant has claimed around the time that Snowflake was claiming that they didn't see any evidence for sure that there was any other hacks happening, Mandiant said, that there's other hacks happening. We're seeing traffic. We're seeing other things going on. So Mandiant, the Google company, security company, was looking into this. And June 17th, the story updates, because I just read this right before we went on air, it was reported that Wired, that the threat actor supposedly gained access by breaching a contractor account. So here we're going to come full circle back to authentication, keys, and access. And allegedly, that individual had some sort of a key or credential that they used at the cloud provider to assist, you know, other customers. Now, that might sound strange at first. Some people might be thinking, well, wait a minute, cloud provider, they're being assisted. I don't know much about Snowflake, but I do know, like, there's managed service providers. There's obviously cloud providers where you just go your own route. But conceivably, I don't know. Let me know what your thoughts are on this, but, you know, I would think big accounts like Adobe and Canva on a cloud provider probably has reps or somebody working on the inside to keep them happy or to keep their systems going. Either way, there was a contractor, and allegedly that contractor was the in. It was a spear phishing attack, and info stealing malware was placed on a contractor's account, which then allowed that individual to gain credentials for companies that are hosted on Snowflake, which means that there's other companies that are victim to this, most likely, that have yet to come forward.
I think there is a bit more to this than just that. So the third-party contractor, they keep naming a company called EPAM Systems, E-P-A-M Systems. And apparently that company is a service provider. It basically assists companies in using Snowflake's infrastructure. It's more or less like, say, you have companies using Salesforce, and then there's a third party that comes in and helps your company use Salesforce. Because that company that's helping you has a deep knowledge of how Salesforce works, and they implement solutions based on Salesforce and all of that. And in this case, EPAM was assisting other companies with using Snowflake's infrastructure. So the thing here is that apparently the breach occurred in one of EPAM's employees, in one of their personal systems. And that employee of EPAM had credentials for other customers on how they accessed the Snowflake infrastructure. For example, Ticketmaster was one, Santander was another, LendingTree, Advanced Auto Parts, many different companies.
Wow.
To give you an idea, EPAM has a yearly money flow in the order of the billions. 4.8 billions or something like that, so it's not a small company. And one of the contractors working, one of the employees working for EPAM had the credentials for other companies, and they were helping the other companies. If you recall the GTA source code leak, it also came from somebody's personal laptop being infected with ransomware or being infected, sorry, not ransomware, being infected with malware, which was then used to exfiltrate the data from that laptop and eventually get inside of the company's systems. In this case, it was also a personal laptop that was being used to do EPAM's work that got infected with malware. And one piece of data that was on that laptop, apparently in a Jira, Jira is a process management system, a project management system. And in that project management system, you can entry details about different things that you're doing on a project. And in those details, apparently, that employee of EPAM was adding credentials that he would use at a particular point in time. And that was not encrypted. So when that laptop got compromised, the attacker managed to read the data that was on those Jira tickets and get the credentials that way. There are so many things going wrong for this to be able to happen that, yeah.
Well, I'll just mention real quick, the first malware threat I've ever dealt with at work a long time ago, you know, when you have malware that's a worm that's infiltrating things and infecting systems left and right, that situation, and this is the first time ever, was caused by somebody who let, according to him anyway, it was probably his fault, but he was blaming his wife, and said that she downloaded something and plugs in his computer to the work network, and next thing you know, there's malware. Obviously, I don't know who did what or care, but the point is that this story is as old as my career, older than my career. It's been going on longer than my career. We've had these issues going on. And it doesn't change. We say the same things. You know, a contractor computer, a employee computer was taken over, an API key was put into a repository, an update wasn't installed, although we're not talking about updates right now. But the point is, there needs to be action. We have contractors working at a company, especially a big one. It's really hard to control information. And this is the really big problem. If you hire a contractor, you know, even if you do everything right, security training and everything we've mentioned, you know, you can't watch everything that they're doing. And obviously, that would be kind of creepy. But the point is, they could be putting credentials in Notepad, for all we know. They could be, in this case, putting things in Jira, which I've seen many, many times. And companies that use Jira are usually large, at least in my experience. The larger the company, the more information, the harder it is to make sure your employees aren't writing things on sticky notes. I mean, I feel like when you have contractors working at your company, there has to be a means of giving them access, even though it's annoying, you know, as needed per project, per thing, or having some kind of a way to gatekeep these credentials. Because if they're put in the hands of someone else and we don't have a tracking on that, then how could we track it? That's the biggest problem is the bigger the company, the more people, the more one person doesn't know what the other person's doing, the more moving pieces at the company, the more potential for things to be in Jira. And that's exactly what happened here. And yeah, that's just the story. I mean, we've been talking about these things a lot.
You can't actually prevent people from writing notes, from writing sticky notes and placing them on all the wrong places. We've seen that in the past many, many times. We continue to see that writing them on Jira tickets, it's exactly the same thing. However, there's quite a few things that could have happened here to avoid this. Essentially, Snowflake wasn't enforcing multi-factor authentication on the accounts. So you could have accounts, important accounts from important customers, where there was no multi-factor authentication.
Okay, let's just underscore that. No requirement for multi-factor authentication at a cloud provider. Now, that's a facepalm moment if there ever was one.
And again, it's the type of things that could have prevented this from happening in the first place. Multi-factor authentication, regardless of them getting your username and password, they would not be able to log in because they would lack the other factor. Mm-hmm. Then there's also the fact that when you're dealing with third parties, in this case EPAM, assisting your company, you're handing them credentials that have full access to your own tenant. So if you're Santander, and this was in fact the case, or if you're Ticketmaster and you're dealing with EPAM and you want EPAM to help you with Snowflake, you're handing them credentials that give them full control over your Snowflake account. There are probably better ways to delegate access than just giving them full access.
Yes, there definitely is. There definitely is. That's an understatement. But it's like, I don't know. I mean, what I think is happening is people are starting to get educated on the cloud in ways that they may not have wanted to, because, you know, it's some people that don't know about cloud, you know, some CTOs that are new, oh, it's the new thing, it's a new way forward. And it's advertised as, you know, this thing you could utilize. You don't have to manage your hardware, which you don't. You could have your software running on someone else's server, but we really have to make sure we know how someone else's server is run, what policies are there. And, you know, mistakes are made. I guess my point is, when you have any provider, whether it's an MSP, a cloud provider, you have to be able to trust them, because your company can get a hit because of something that you didn't even do, just because you trusted the wrong company. Or, you know, we just talked about a cloud account that just, you know, servers disappearing. So we're starting to get a really good idea of the shared responsibility model. And this isn't even shared responsibility. It's almost like a shared facepalm is what it became.
Yeah, we need to do a disclaimer at this point that EPAM continues to deny that they have been involved in this. It's important to underscore that we have named them, and we need to make sure that people understand that from EPAM's perspective, they do not see any activity that is connected to this event.
I'm glad you've mentioned that.
They have put out the statement mentioning that, so keep that in mind when you're remembering the story. It may not be exactly as we have described it so far. We may not know all the details.
Oh yeah, we definitely don't.
There is another aspect that I mentioned before, I briefly mentioned that, which is old credentials are being used. We don't know if it's old credentials because those are the credentials stolen in this incident right now, or if it was just old credentials that have been found as part of another dump on another incident previously and just happened to be the same that have been used on the Snowflake infrastructure. It could have been that. Like I said, lumping together multiple data breaches and creating these huge dumps of personal information, of logins and passwords that then make the rounds on the news websites, 100 billion accounts for sale and the dark web or something like that. We've seen that. We've seen lots of very massive dumps. Those are just different breaches that have been lumped together and the data has just been stitched together. There's obviously repeated logins in there and repeated credentials. it might have been something like this. We just don't know, and it's difficult to speculate. But the premise of what we have been just saying, that we need to have better ways to approach how we handle third parties dealing with infrastructure and using our tenants on cloud providers and all of that, oh, that's a guarantee. We really need to improve that. One way that this can be improved, and this touches directly on the Linux enterprise side of things, is that we need to have systems, and this could have prevented so many of the breaches that we have discussed in this podcast so far. We need to have something called Network Access Control, NAC, in place. Network Access Control for the Linux sysadmin is essentially running a Radius server. You run Radius, Radius plugs into your wireless login process or plugs into your OpenVPN server login process, so that the systems that get added to your wireless network or the systems that connect to your infrastructure through a VPN go through the policies that you define in Radius. Radius lets you specify things like you need to have an endpoint protection software enabled, you need to have your updates installed, you need to be running this application that we specify, and having that in place, while not 100% guaranteed that nothing like this could happen, it would still catch the bottom 90 or 95% of attacks and 90 or 95% of malware threats that try to get into systems. Simply having some type of enforcement that you apply to third-party equipment that gets connected to your network is definitely an improvement and could have helped in many of the situations that we've described on this episode and on many previous episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. One potential workaround that I implemented a long time ago in my career at the company I was working for at an MSP was that each person working on the project would have a virtual machine dedicated for that client, no connection to any other client, just that one client, and it's just that one user, and then it's deleted as soon as that person's done working with the client. Sure, it's a pain, to be honest. Automation can spin up VMs and earmark them for a particular client. And obviously it takes policies because someone could still open Notepad in a virtual machine and save a password on their desktop all the same, just like any other computer. But the idea being that, you know, computers are easier to take over. Here's a dedicated instance. Do what you have to do for the client, get rid of it, and then move on. But, you know, we have to come up with, you know, things like this to try to protect us, because even if we're doing the right thing and then we find out like this, there's no multi-factor authentication requirement at a cloud provider, then the weakest link isn't us. It's who we chose to do business with that can become the weakest link. And it's just, we really have to vet these. And it's hard because even if you vet a company, all it takes is one person at that company to make a mistake, and it could happen anytime. And it does all the time.
It's like every other week for us here. Again, another facepalm story. I really don't want to digress too much on this one because we have another big story that I would like to cover today. So if you don't mind, if you don't want to add anything else to this Ticketmaster story, I'll move on to the next one.
I do want to just mention one thing in regard to EPAM's statement. They're saying that they feel that that the whole thing has been fabricated, that there's, you know, nothing going on. I just wanted to make sure that there people know that they're suggesting the hacker has fabricated everything involving EPAM being the culprit. So that's what they're saying. Again, just wanted to get that out there, but we can move on.
Okay, so you may not be following this, but I assure you that this next story is very relevant for the Linux world and it is impacting cybersecurity in a serious way. Mm-hmm. Back in February, the Linux kernel team has announced that they had become a CNA, which is a CVE numbering authority. We have even talked about this before in the podcast. It was a surprising move, given the very public and very strongly harsh position that the kernel team had until then. They had very publicly made remarks that the CVE system was flawed, probably beyond repair, and that they simply patched security bugs and never filed CVEs on them. This is why they always ensured that they always told people that you should always run the most up-to-date version of the kernel, and you didn't knew what was fixed, but you knew that every single version would include security fixes. There are good arguments for and against this position. I will not go over them today. Their current stance when they became a CNA changed completely. Now the official position that the kernel team has is that every bug fix gets a CVE. Because the kernel team has no way of knowing where you're going to be running the kernel, they have no way of guessing which bug can become a security problem or not. So everything gets a CVE. It's like Oprah. You get a TV, you get a TV, and you get a TV, now everybody gets a CVE. So at the time, there were people that complained that this could become a problem. How much of a problem? Well, now we have a good idea of how much of a problem. Between 2006 and 2018, there were 1,005 CVEs that affected the kernel directly. Okay? 2006 to 2018, there were 1,005 CVEs that affected the kernel. Since the kernel CNA started to operate in February until the end of May, just until the end of May, basically the first 3 months that it operated, they issued over 2,000 new CVEs for the kernel. Let that sink in. 2,000 CVEs affecting the kernel from February to the end of May.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know about you, but I don't know any company that is taking down their systems 2,000 times to do updates from February to the end of May.
No, I think that's a lot to ask for. It's a lot to ask for, even for our audience.
This is this is becoming a problem in such a way that it's affecting everything from scoring CVEs, because the kernel team won't assign scores to the CVEs. They only issue the CVEs. So someone else has to go over each CVE, understand if it's dangerous or not, and assign it a score. In a very poor turn of fate, the National Vulnerability Database, NVD, that usually analyzes and provides more information on CVEs, started to wind down their operations basically around the same time that the kernel started issuing CVEs. So this just compounded the problem. To the point that from those 2,000 CVEs that they issued, the vast majority of them hasn't even been scored.
That's a lot of work to get through.
Take a moment to consider that. We have over 1,000 CVEs since February until the end of May, affecting just the kernel, that haven't even yet been scored. They have been made public. The description of the problem has been made public. Where the problem exists in the code has been made public. There is a code fix for it. But again, if you're not patching for it for all of them, then you don't have the code fix yet in place.
So what does this do for compliance when you have companies that, in order to be compliant, they have to install updates, and then they find out that there's 2,000, you know, problems in the kernel that they need to address? Does that make them out of compliance all of a sudden?
Yeah, that's one of the problems that this has been compounding. It obviously makes them fail compliance checks because it's impossible to keep up with this. There are just simply too many patches to keep up with. To the tune that 20 new CVEs are being issued every single day, whether it's a weekday or a holiday or at the end of the week, you're getting 20 new CVEs affecting the kernel every single day on average. And that's just way too much to handle and way too much to keep track of. Now, this is a problem for everybody that's trying to keep their system secure, because your vulnerability scanners also get data from the CVE system, so they will continuously be receiving information that you need to patch for this, need to patch for this. And when your systems get scanned, they will start to be flagged for the new CVEs, even if you haven't gotten to the part where you need to patch them and you have no idea that this is the amount of patches that is coming your way. You would get essentially the same fixes as you would before, okay? Because they're not making up fixes. They're simply assigning CVEs to them. Previously, you wouldn't get a CVE if it wasn't a security fix, but right now they don't really care. They issue this on every single bug fix that gets through the kernel.
You feel that this is passive aggressive on their part, the kernel team's part? Because it almost seems that way in a little bit.
You know, there's this famous, and I keep referring to it because it's really an amazing presentation by Greg Crowe Hartman, which happens to also be the responsible person on the kernel team to the kernel CNA. He's the one in charge, essentially, or at least the one organizing it. There is this presentation called CVEs Are Dead, Long Live the CVEs, in which he consistently bashes the CVEs and points out every single flaws in this. This is a 2019 presentation. It's from where that number, those 1,005 CVEs number comes from. It's from his own presentation. This is his own data. There is a Q&A at the end. The very last question that they put to him is that, okay, so the system is broken, should we just burn it down and start over again? And he laughs and he says, well, maybe not burn it all down. Man, that comment has aged very poorly. I don't know if this is malicious compliance. I don't know if they're simply following a process. We're talking about really smart people here. They know exactly what they're doing. Nothing around this is an accident. They know exactly what they're doing. They might have the best intentions in the world. We're laser focused on CVEs. All of our infrastructure is built around handling CVEs, scoring CVEs, addressing them, having patches for the CVEs, getting systems flagged when they're not patched for a given CVE. So when the number of CVEs starts to explode like it has since February, and affecting basically any Linux system out there, things start to go downhill really quickly. And then there's additional things that they are doing that are just different from other CNAs. One blatant example. A few months back, it was probably on one of the earliest episodes of the podcast, there was a vulnerability on curl. Curl, the command line download tool.
Are you about to mention wget, by the way?
No, because I'm going to use...
Yeah, okay. I was just going to make that example too.
So curl a couple of years ago had the vulnerability and had the CVE filed for that vulnerability. And it turned out that the code where that vulnerability resided had been included in curl in 1999. So it had been in the code base for 23 years. And the CVE came out just 2 years ago. So it was CVE-2022-something. I don't recall the exact number. The kernel CNA does things slightly different, and again with a huge impact. They are backfilling the CVEs. So if the bug fix that they are creating the CVE for is from 5 years ago, they will issue a CVE with an identifier from 5 years ago. So you are seeing CVEs being issued this year with identifiers starting with CVE-2019-something.
Oh wow.
When you run a vulnerability scanner against the system, and it comes out as being vulnerable to CVE-2019-something, you have to explain to your auditors that, yeah, that vulnerability hasn't been known for 5 years and we haven't patched it. That vulnerability was issued just 2 months ago and we are going to patch it on time. It has a whole lot of ramifications. It has a whole lot of issues, that decision that they're doing. And they are the only CNA that I'm aware of that does this backfilling of CVEs. If right now you find a vulnerability on any product and you try to file a vulnerability, a CVE for it, it will always get assigned the year identifier of the year that it's requested. That's completely different from what they are doing. The different approaches that they have to this make the problem harder to solve than...
The problems with CVE numbering and scoring, it's just been a topic we've been bringing up, and I was going to bring up a recent wget CVE because I think it's a perfect example of this. I don't remember the details off the top of my head, but if I remember correctly, a wget CVE got a score of like 8, and it's wget. So think about that for a minute. It's a tool we use to download things from the internet. Usually it's used as a one-off. You need to grab an ISO or whatever it is. There's a vulnerability, and it got an 8, okay? Now, when the system is working, you might get a report that says something like, here's the CVE number, it's a 10, remote code execution, no authentication. That score is accurate. You need to take care of that because, you know, especially if it's actively exploited. So, you know, in that example, the system works. There's a CVE that scores a 10, it fits. People can get into your system. But when wget is able to score an 8, that just kind of goes to show you just how, in my opinion, crazy this is, because an 8 is like critical. You need to fix it now. Maybe not as important as a 10, but it's pretty darn important. But people don't use Wget as a service exposed to the internet. So you have some situations we've seen where we have a CVE that gets like a 9 or a 10, but it requires someone to already have access to the machine. And then it's like a facepalm. If someone has access to the machine, they could do whatever they want to do with it. It doesn't matter what the CVE is. But in this situation, it's just we need a system to where we could say these specific vulnerabilities need to be patched and these ones may not affect us or might not be relevant. And we do have that. It's just that we have so much other stuff in there to weed out the things that we really do need to take advantage or, you know, fix. And that defeats the whole purpose of having a list, in my opinion. We need something to go by. And now if we're going to have CVEs for typos in the Linux kernel, there's going to be a lot more of them.
The scoring system, CVSS, it has major flaws. You can see the same CVE having one score in one registry and having a different one on another one. Notoriously, Red Hat scores CVEs slightly different than other databases. If for no other reason, then they have an internal process that forces them that every CVE code fix has to be included into the source code that they release if it goes above a certain threshold. So the code that they want to get into their source, into their Linux distributions, if they really want to rush it, they will file a CVE against it and make sure that it gets scored above a certain threshold to make sure that it's included faster. It's abused in many different ways. Obviously, the vendors don't want the score to be so high, and the people that are requesting the CVE want it to be as high as possible because it looks great on their resumes. Mm-hmm. There are lots of different things here. But the difference with this situation, with the Linux CNA, is that the explosion in the number of CVEs makes the entire process just slow down so much. You don't have enough time to score them. You don't have enough time to properly analyze each one, even if the vast majority, like you said, are just typos or just random things that will never become a security problem. In fact, one of the flaws that Greg Crowe-Hartman pointed to the CVE system in 2019 was exactly that. CVEs were being filed for things that would never be a security problem. For example, one example that he gives in his presentation was that somebody filed a CVE because on a given error condition where you were out of memory on a system, you were failing to release I don't know how many bytes or something like that. And it was impossible to exploit that because the system was already out of memory, so everything would crash anyway. And somebody filed a CVE for that, and it was an entire process around it. He has very good points about it. And that's the thing. Wow. He has great points about how that system was broken. And the mindset at the time was that they should find an alternative to the CVE system. And 5 years go by, and they become a CNA themselves. And even if they are not maliciously complying, which again, I don't believe they are. I believe they are doing this with the best of possible intentions. They are introducing so much entropy into the system that they're making everybody else's work that deals with CVEs so much harder. This goes from the distro maintainers that now have to track many more vulnerabilities that they need to include in their products. This goes to the developers that are trying to solve security problems. This goes to the end users that somehow want to keep their system secure and see new vulnerabilities popping up every single day. It's really, really tricky to keep up with this. I'm going to plug something here. TechScare will be making a report available by sysadmin that deals specifically with this problem, provides you the numbers. This affects, basically our focus is on the LTS enterprise version. So if you have an enterprise distribution, you will likely be receiving LTS versions of the kernel with that distribution. We have a breakdown of the amount of CVEs that affect each of the different LTS versions. And believe me, there are a lot of LTS versions out there, and many of these CVEs affect either all of them or just a subset of them, but it will be important for you to understand if you're running an Ubuntu LTS or you're running a CentOS or you're running RHEL itself. It will be relevant to you to know how much vulnerabilities are being thrown your way and how much you have to patch. And again, this is just 3 months period of time for the CNA to be in operation, and they have already more than doubled the amount of CVEs from the previous 15 years.
Wow, that's crazy. I wonder what it's going to be like in 10 years trying to, wrangle IT in general and all the servers. It's just growing bigger than we are at this point, to put it lightly. So can't wait to check out that report. Yes, SysAdmin Day is coming up, so we'll definitely have a lot to talk about. So any other points on that story?
Just to mention that, like our latest downloadables, this will be a no strings attached downloadable. You don't have to give us your email or anything. It's just a free downloadable that we'll make available.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll mention it right here as soon as it's available.
Again, if you're not tracking this situation with the Linux kernel CNA, you need to start paying attention if you're managing any Linux systems, and you most assuredly are if you're paying attention to the podcast with this title. This is a really big story that's happening, and it's going to affect every single product that touches on cybersecurity.
Yep, sure will. And we'll be talking about it going forward as well, and any other security shenanigans that we encounter along the way.
Thanks everybody who's listening. Thanks to everybody who's watching on YouTube. As always, it was a pleasure, and until the next one.
See you next time.